We're just coming out of a Labor Day weekend in which health officials practically begged people not to hold large gatherings at which COVID-19 could be spread. All time, the country passed 40 million total cases just in the last few days. The New York Times reports hospitalizations this Labor Day up 160% over a year ago. Oregon's governor plans a briefing for mid-morning today to give an update on the renewed masking requirements and other measures designed to check the spread of COVID. That is the backdrop for this week's visit with Dr. Jim Shames, medical director at Jackson County Health and Human Services, coming back to answer our questions once again. Dr. Shames, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
I don't have a number from the weekend in front of me. I don't know if you do, but most of last week, it seemed like Jackson County's new case number was on a downward glide compared to the week before. What do you see?
Well, the data is a little scant after a three-day weekend, but it does appear that the numbers we know about are lower than they were a week or two ago. We can hope that that's a genuine trend that we're looking at.
I was just looking at Oregon's trend pathway, and it does look to untrained eyes like mine like it might be at least flattening out on top. But it was on an upward swing from July onward, and just looks like it might be plateauing. But too early to say. Just before the weekend, there was a warning from your agency about holiday weekend gatherings. What did you request of people?
Well, I think people need to be aware that we're at a very precarious time and that we have a highly contagious, omnipresent virus in our community, and that hopefully at this point all the things that people know from the last year and a half can come into play and be really careful about getting together with people outside their family, wearing masks, being distant. The complicating factor is that the air quality in the Rogue Valley is so poor that, you know, the admonition to do it outside, if you're going to do it at all, is difficult. So I recognize it's a hard time for people, and it's a hard time to be safe.
Oh, true. Yeah, that's true. You were asking people, you know, don't do your stuff indoors, but then outdoors is not good for their health either.
Yeah.
Are there any signs that people followed the advice or heeded the requests of county health?
Yeah, I don't know, because I was indoors without socializing. I don't really know. I think, you know, that information will come in over the week. Mm-hmm. I don't even have any anecdotes, really.
Okay, we'll be looking at the numbers in the days ahead. Let's see, JW, No Town Given, has a couple of questions by email. The first question has to do with getting other vaccinations as we look ahead to possible mRNA boosters. What's the best protocol for spacing out the time between, say, the current flu, shingles, or pneumonia vaccines and the potential upcoming COVID vax booster? I'll hold the second question.
So if the question is, you know, can you take all the shots at once or should you space them out? We don't really know the answer to that, but the advice is certainly in terms of the shingles vaccine is to not do it simultaneous. And that may have to do as much with the fact that the shingles vaccine, you know, can make you feel uncomfortable for a couple of days, as can the COVID vaccine. And you may not want to add insult to injury. But I don't believe there's a problem getting the flu shot and the COVID shot in close proximity with each other.
Okay.
Was there another part to this question?
Yeah, the second part of the question was about surfaces, about the contagiousness of the Delta variant on surfaces. The original COVID virus was shown not to be transmitted often by touch, and it seems like a lot of the aerosol stuff was what became the bigger issue. Is there any evidence that Delta is more transmittable by touching surfaces, you know, the doorknobs, the high-touch areas?
I'm going to have to assume that it's more transmissible by every means. You know, if in fact, you know, less virus can get you sick, then that small amount of virus on touch surfaces, which may not have gotten you sick with the Alpha variant, may get you sick with Delta. So I guess I would increase diligence in every respect, which would probably be just sort of simple hand washing and cleaning, you know, frequently touched surfaces. I think it's probably a good idea.
Okay, so this is good to know, because if people relented a bit on sanitizing surfaces, it might be in order again. If it's transmissible, as you point out, it's more transmissible, period.
Yeah, I think the basic rules haven't changed. It's probably primarily transmissible by droplet spread, meaning that if you're more than 3 feet away from somebody, you're unlikely to get those droplets on you. But, you know, even though there's been some risk from aerosol and some risk from touch, all the ways you could get the virus are more likely with Delta than with the previous variants. So I don't think it's changed what we've learned over time, but it's more transmissible, period.
Okay, those questions again from JW, who writes, thank you very much for your service to our community. So a nice round of applause for the health office there. I want to come back to shingles for just a second. Who are the people who should be getting shingles shots, particularly vis-a-vis their experience with chickenpox when younger?
Yeah, so as a reminder, shingles is a re-exacerbation of chickenpox. The chickenpox virus lives in your body, dormant, and then for reasons that are complicated can occasionally come out. And then it has a different form, which are these painful blisters that pop up at the ends of nerves at various parts of your body. And, you know, at its best, it's a painful annoyance. At its worst, it's a serious ongoing chronic problem. We have a Shingrix vaccine, which is quite effective. I believe it's recommended for those over the age of 60. I don't remember the age exactly, but it's for the older population. Even if you've had other shingles shots, this is the one that you should be getting. It was in short supply for a while, but hopefully that supply chain has increased to the point where you can get it at pharmacies, you can get it at your doctor's office, et cetera.
Wow, I see that CDC recommends healthy adults 50 and older get two doses of Shingrix, separated by 2 to 6 months. So, yeah, you don't want to get
Thanks
too close
that.
With that and not too close to anything else. Okay, that is good to know. Yeah. Dr. Jim Shames, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange as we go through our weekly question and answer session about COVID and latest issues. You can certainly join the segment here at the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Let's see. We have Leah asking the same question as Charles, which is about the mu variant. Actually, Charles wanted to know about the lambda variant. So, two variants that we're trying to nail down here. What's up with either one of those?
You know, I don't have any recent information on any of the other variants at this point. I think we're still tracking them. Some of the unknowns about the new variants are, you know, how effective is the vaccine against them? Are they likely to be so transmissible that they are going to supplant, the Delta variant? I don't know. You know, it's just something I haven't looked at the latest data on.
All right, but at this point, the major concern is still Delta, because as Charles
Absolutely.
Points it out, Delta, Delta, Delta is all I hear or see, but that is the number one concern at the moment.
It is, and it's really hard to take data, especially when it's coming internationally, and, you know, learn what you need to learn from it. I think a good example would be the information that comes out of the CDC. Their obligation is to give you information as quickly as possible, and yet sometimes they give you incomplete information, so people get confused. So at the moment, there's a lot we don't know about the new variants that are circulating around the world.
Well, and it seems to me, too, particularly when we start talking about things like replication numbers, R-naughts, and things like that, I mean, a lot of what happens with a particular strain of any disease is influenced greatly by human behavior.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, that's why the concept of R-naught and infectivity is so fluid, is that it really depends a lot on where you live and how you live. You know, if you're live in the middle of Wyoming, you don't have a lot of contact with people, that the theoretical R naught of a virus doesn't really matter much.
No, it doesn't. But then if you live in a place where not only are people fairly close together, but also aren't particularly concerned about something and continue to hang out and breathe in each other's faces, that's going to make a difference.
Absolutely.
All right, let's take a call on the phone here from Steve in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Jim Shames from Jackson County Health and Human Services.
Yeah, thanks, Jeffrey. I wanted to get the doc's take on this spike in use of ivermectin, the vet med for worms for horses. And I've got a lot of anti-vax friends who are promoting this, and I've noticed in the papers that there's a high spike of that. I was curious the doc's take on that.
Okay, thanks for the question, Steve. Appreciate that. Ivermectin, we have talked about before, but what are you noticing lately? Are people heeding some of the warnings about it?
Oh, I don't really know. I think it still has a mind of its own, this ivermectin concept. I just want to be clear that this is a drug that has legitimate human purposes. It is an anti-parasitic drug for human use as well as veterinary use. And it's been around a really long time. It's not a mysterious drug. It works by paralyzing the nervous system of parasites, and it's because it doesn't penetrate the blood-brain barrier in humans, it can kill some organisms without killing us. And there's some deep theoretical reasons why perhaps drugs like that could have some effect on viruses. And, you know, I think most people at this point know the story that, you know, a few prominent docs promoted ivermectin. They did some fairly uncontrolled studies to suggest that ivermectin was really a miracle drug. And a lot of folks kind of jumped on that bandwagon thinking that perhaps somehow that the medical industry was hiding information. I think the information at this point is pretty clear that we have no compelling evidence that ivermectin is particularly effective. I don't think inherently it's a terribly dangerous drug, but, you know, you start taking horse formulations for something or formulations that weren't meant to be ingested, and you can certainly do yourself some harm. The painful problem for me is that we do have a very effective treatment for COVID. Monoclonal antibodies are really powerful treatments for people who have not yet, gotten sick enough to be hospitalized. And we should be utilizing them extensively. And in the meantime, people are distracted by ivermectin, which probably is of no value. So I would love to see people who are concerned that they really want a treatment for COVID and get the treatment that works. Talk to their healthcare provider and say, you know, I've got COVID, I'm not feeling well. You know, how do I get monoclonal antibody? That's where the attention ought to be.
All right. So once infected, again, this is when you start asking for monoclonal antibodies, when you start not feeling well but haven't gotten to the point of hospitalization.
Yeah. Although, you know, if you're immunocompromised and you're elderly and, you know, your nephew just came to visit and, you know, lived in your house and told you that they're now positive for COVID, that would be an opportunity to get prophylactic monoclonal antibodies. But at the moment, we're really putting our efforts primarily into individuals who test positive.
All right, so back to ivermectin again. As you point out, there is the veterinary version, but there also is a human version that is an anti-parasitic, an anti-worm medication, basically. And you use the phrase, you know, something that can kill other organisms without killing us. It really is a pick your poison kind of thing, though, because what you're doing like this, and well, for that matter, with chemotherapy. I mean, you're getting to the point where you're trying to kill something in your body without killing you at the same time. Versus a vaccine,
sure.
It takes a totally different approach.
Sure. I mean, it's not an unusual, you know, phenomenon, which is what antibiotics do or antivirals do. But monoclonal antibodies are really very different. It's taking a manufactured version of the antibodies that you would normally produce to protect yourself and giving them in high targeted quantities at the moment you need them the most. It's conceptually a much safer kind of treatment rather than, you know, the unproven and potentially dangerous use of a drug like ivermectin.
Well, but then this again is, I mean, so monoclonal antibodies, you're saying yes, and vaccines, they're going to help your body create antibodies, correct? This is not like a poison to you.
No, yeah. the vaccine is the way to go. It's the only safe way to get us out of this pandemic. But if you have chosen not to get vaccinated and now you're sick with COVID, turning to ivermectin is really not going to change the trajectory of your disease, as far as I can tell. But monoclonal antibodies certainly could.
Dr. Jim Shames, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange, the medical director at Jackson County Health and Human Services. You got a question for the doctor? Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I was just looking at the hospital situation, and it doesn't look like it's changed much over the last couple of weeks. I see in the region that is Jackson and Josephine counties, I see one ICU bed available.
Well, the hospitals are still pretty full, although we're still, collating the data that came in over the 3-day weekend. I'm hoping that our time to turn the corner has arrived, and I'm certainly hoping that some of the hospital data will start turning as well. In the past, what we've noticed is that case rates drop before the hospital rates drop. So if, in fact, the case rates are plateauing or decreasing locally, then we could expect that the hospital rates will follow, but it may be, 10 days behind.
Okay, that makes sense, yeah. And Jackson County, in the week before last, was still seeing, at least in one day, like 400 cases. Friday is the most recent one we have a figure for, I guess, 195. So that would indicate a bit of a change there, we hope, in the downward trend. And you're saying so then a bit of a lag then before you start seeing hospitalizations drop?
Yeah, that's what we would expect. But again, if in fact we are going down a bit in terms of cases, then we could expect, hopefully, that we're going to see the same thing at some point soon from hospitals.
I'll have to make sure I share this one chart I'm looking at from Oregon Health Authority that shows hospitalizations for COVID in the state of Oregon, and it shows that on November 30th, there were 584 COVID-19 positive patients. That was the previous high before the current spike. That chart only went up to 1,000, and it had to be adjusted to go even higher, because then it got to, on September 1st, 1,178, so not quite double the previous high in the end of November of last year. So that's just how drastically things changed in hospitals.
Yeah, that's statewide. It's almost double. Locally, it's almost triple. As bad as that graphic looks for the state as a whole, it looks even worse for Region 5, which is Josephine and Jackson County.
Mm-hmm. And are you seeing some of these out-of-state workers that have been brought in by the governor's office to assist? Are they doing things in Jackson County?
They are doing things in Jackson County, and those are real numbers. I think we're seeing some relief in the emergency rooms, relief on the floors, some relief in helping logistics of getting people tested and vaccinated. So that personnel happened pretty quickly, and it happened in enough time to really give us relief. So I would say that the emergency authorizations and the arrival of personnel happened in a timely fashion, and we're grateful for that.
Are there any indications with staffing that you have any medical workers that are opting to leave rather than to get vaccinated themselves?
Well, there's a lot of concern about it, but no one exactly knows how it's going to play out until the time finally comes. But there is concern that that key personnel are going to be lost, and we'll have to kind of limp along and see if they can be replaced.
And what reasons do you hear from people who work in medical fields for not getting vaccinated?
Well, it's the same reasons as what you hear from the rest of the population. Just because you are an admitting clerk at the hospital doesn't mean that you have a different philosophical belief system than, the people you hang out with that are your friends in your social world. I think that's really it. It's a divided country, and it doesn't, stop at the walls of a hospital or a medical clinic. Unfortunately, the nature of the work is that you can't avoid putting other people at risk if you're unvaccinated or you decide you don't want to wear a mask. And even if you do it at work, if you do it off work, if you put yourself at risk when you're home, then you can easily bring the virus to your workplace, which has vulnerable people in it. So I don't see a way around it. No one likes to be forced to do something, but that is kind of the nature of healthcare. When you go into medicine, many of us find that you know, we don't always get to do what we want when we want it. You know, I didn't really want to get up at 3 a.m. to go deliver a baby, but that's what was happening, and I was sleepy and grumpy, and there's so many examples of the nature of that, and there's times you say, I don't really want to get this vaccine because, I don't know, it hasn't been proven to my satisfaction yet, but yet, I have to do it because not doing it is going to put vulnerable people at risk, and that's the nature of the work.
All right,
protecting others.
Yeah, well, I guess the wish is that the rest of us all think like healthcare workers in that respect. It's like, you know, it's not something you necessarily want to do, but you know, it helps. It helps other people.
Yeah.
Dr. Jim Shames, Jackson County Medical Director at Jackson County Health and Human Services. Thanks for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange to answer our questions.
Oh, you bet. Glad to be here.